And you're very welcome to another edition of the Solid Foundations Property Podcast. And, well, if you're listening to this, it is November 2024, another year just flown by. Well, on this month's Property Podcast, we go back into the archives and we hear from renowned Irish property investor, Mrs. Catherine Brennan. Catherine, who started her career as an accountant, is now a prominent property investor here in Ireland. Her story holds no punches and delves into the reality of property investing. We discuss the highs, the lows of Catherine's career and her advice to any budding property investor. So let's get into this month's edition of the Solid Foundations Property Podcast. The Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you by Gap Property Investments, helping you get a better return on your money through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com. And also, it's brought to you by CityStays, offering bespoke accommodation for large teams of employees or subcontractors that requires accommodation quickly. Check out CityStays.ie. This week on the programme, joined by Mayo native Catherine Brennan from Intelligent Property. Catherine's career is an interesting one. She has over 22 years experience in property and with a background as an accountant, financial advisor, life coach and interior designer. Catherine's unique story delves deep into her life and business, from having it all to her biggest mistakes and her biggest ones. The property specialist offers some great nuggets and advice for anyone in business.
Thank you for listening. Wherever you are in the world, it's always good to connect to people everywhere. I get texts from all over Europe and even as far away as Mayo. Let's head to Mayo for today's edition, of course. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Catherine Brennan from Intelligent Property. Don't let the word property fool you. This lady, of course, comes with serious pedigree. She has a lot of experience in all different aspects of that entrepreneurial journey, and also has had a very interesting past, and we're going to dig a bit deeper. How are you doing, Catherine?
Good morning. How are you, Warwick? Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, Catherine, to the Breadwinners Podcast. And as I said, of course, you currently, your company, Intelligent Property. We'll start there. What exactly is Intelligent Property? And does it do what it says in the tin, that old catchphrase?
Or is it
something else we should know about?
Yes, it does indeed. I suppose the idea is to do property the intelligent way. My other company is called Intelligent Business Consulting. So it's all, I suppose, my focus is about doing things the smart way, which might not be the most obvious way. So to get the maximum results, I suppose, for the minimum efforts, and to have your taxes and your finances and all of those things in order as well, that you're not stacking up problems for yourself further down the road.
That comes a very mixed bag, Catherine, and obviously you've got the experience over the last number of years to have a business now like that that can offer those particular services. But where did you all start now? Where did this roller coaster start for you? Maybe we'll dig back a couple of years ago. Take us back to your early years in business. Where did you
start? Yes. So I suppose I left school wanting to do law or accountancy. I suppose that's thanks to television there's no thrilling programs about accountants on television, but law always seemed to be an exciting job. And it's funny, I've ended up in a mix of both, really. I suppose property has measures of both. So I, at the time, there was more jobs really in accountancy. And there was no jobs for young solicitors at the time. So I sort of took the long route. So I went to college. I actually qualified in secondary school teaching first. So I was probably nearly 22 when I started accountancy. But I started working and doing accountancy part-time. So I'd be in college evenings, weekends, but I had a degree in economics, so I had a small amount of exemptions. Teaching wasn't for me, and really it was... But I did know I like lecturing and stuff. So it's transferable skills, really, to coach and to train and to anything you do, is about being able to explain yourself. you know, there's a lot of people who know a lot of things that aren't able to get their message across. So then I went on, qualified as an accountant around 3 years later, I suppose. And I was working in industry at the time. So I very quickly went from assistant accountant to I was a finance controller in a fairly big company in Dublin by the time I was 26, 27. I was lucky. I was brand newly qualified and I was in charge of a department. I was lucky, really, timing wise. People had just retired ahead of me.
And so through that particular 26, you go into a big company. Confidence obviously wasn't an issue for you, Catherine, because, okay, you can be fairly educated, but you need to have a bit of confidence as well.
Yes.
To actually, and at a tender year age, if you don't mind me saying, people in that genre don't really respect you as much. So how did you get from at college into work and getting the confidence up to deliver at a high level? Because obviously that's what you were doing.
Yes, and some days it's funny, you'd be terrified. You're officially the financial controller, and so an odd day, I would think, oh my God, what if anything that's never happened before happened? Because none of my friends were in charge of the department. Most of them were still battling with the exams, even ones who had started before me. So when I went into this company, I was assistant accountant. So ahead of me, there was a qualified, there was a finance director, and there was a company secretary who'd actually been a finance director in Smurfits. So I had a ton of experience to lean on in those three people. And then suddenly the accountant left. He moved to the Middle East and I was accountant, but I still had this man who had ran the finance department in Smurfits, who was a fantastic mentor. I can still hear his voice, you know, on a Friday evening, I'd be saying, we're nearly done now, you know, we're only a euro out on this, I think, or a pound back in the day. And he'd say, no, Catherine, it could be out 9,999 on one side and 10,000 on the other. You know, you're not done till it's perfect. And being that I was 25, 26, you were trying to get out of the office by the evening. So
and that wee bit of training, suppose at that early stage, suppose it's the method and the detail. Is that something you picked up as you moved along and you look back
yes.
now and you think?
It is. It really is. He was really, really specific on detail. You'd never be allowed off a pound, a fiver, and he was very, very good with people. So there was four other people in the department and he was really, really good, you know, managing people. And, you know, he would tell them if they'd went astray, but in a nice way. So he was a fantastic mentor, because when I look back now, I then set up a practice of my own after that job. It would be highly unusual now to have only ever worked in one place and then to go and set up a practice. If someone else told me they were going to do that now, I would say, oh no, you're far too young. In fact, I only texted a guy yesterday who asked me, and I said, no, you don't have enough experience. You can't go out on your own.
And what age were you then?
I was 27 when I left there, and I was only qualified probably a year and a half. And was that,
and talk us through the thought process there, because I know you just, you're giving advice now. You're telling someone else at 27, don't be doing that. You need to get more, you know, qualified or more experience even. In that regard.
Yes.
Just digging a little bit deeper on that. What was the thought process?
It's funny. We had a lot of change in the place I was in, and I think change or turmoil is where you learn. Where people who've had an easy job just don't have enough experience. So in the time I was there, now I had been in practice, but only for about 6 months. Practice wasn't for me. I wanted to understand the commerce behind accountancy. You know, if your margin is this, how many do you have to sell to do this? And how much will your overheads change? Can you do double the business with the same cost base? So then within that company, in the 3 or 4 years I was there, we had gone we had the year 2000, we had the whole Y2K thing. I'm surprised I even remember the name still. So we'd installed all new systems. I had been the union rep, which is a huge big learning for anyone who works in industry dealing with unions and stuff. It's far from what a lot of accountants are used to, I suppose. And I, then the company, so three of my bosses left, two of them willingly, one of them unwillingly, and the company was sold to a multinational. So between all of that, I'd had probably a far, far greater range of learning. And within that, we had guys in. At the time, they were Baker. Well, they're now Baker Tilly O'Hare, I think. But they were, they were Ryan Glennon back in the day in accountancy practice. And they specialised at the time in time and motion, really, but for accountancy offices. So they would come in and measure the amount of information that had to be processed, and they would basically tell you how you could do your accounts faster, more accurately, and whether you needed more staff or whether they just weren't being done as efficiently. And I had already been thinking, looking around me, gosh, I'm not really needed every day here at all. I had three staff when I was a financial controller. I was thinking, I could show these guys how to do 80% of my work, and then I could learn new things. So having Ryan Glennon in at the time really crystallised my interest in that, in efficiency, in test and measure, in why can some people do something in an hour that takes somebody else 3 hours. So I think having sort of completely identified the niche I wanted to be in, which was going into other companies, transforming the way they do things. And secondly, when the company was sold to a multinational, I didn't enjoy it at all because it is very, very robotic. The decisions are all already made and your input isn't really needed. It's already systemized. It's already tested and measured. And you do things A, B, C. You don't say, I have a good idea. I think we... So I didn't enjoy the multinational environment at all, and I had identified what I wanted to do. So I suppose the two things together made me take the leap quite quickly.
And that work ethos, Catherine, I suppose it's everyone comes out with, you got to work hard, and obviously in every industry you have to work really, really hard to get success. But at a young age, it comes from the morals or the values that's probably installed. And you tell us, suppose, about that as well. You know, it's one thing going into a company that's bought over by a multinational, but it's another thing to be running the company that's been taken over by the multinational. So was there any stages where you thought, how did it get here?
Yeah, it's sometimes an odd time I used to think when in the beginning when my mentor retired, he'd call in an odd time in the beginning. And then I suppose as the months went on, he probably thought I was fine. I didn't. And then sometimes you would think, I'm fully on top of everything that's already happened once. I remember what to do with that. But what about when new things happen? Or am I certain that I can go into a different industry? Because, for example, these guys were in the packaging industry and the production guys were experts, so they didn't need my input. Whereas subsequently, I went into other companies that none of it was running properly. So I was having to try and figure out how they even produce this or what they're buying, or distribution, what they're buying it for, what they're selling it for, what kind of stock levels. At least in this company, it was finance, admin, and staff and kind of HR, I suppose, all the union stuff. And I suppose I've never been a nervous person. Probably from school even. I'd always get blamed if the whole class got in trouble at school because I would have tended to be the ringleader. But also it's the confidence and energy of youth. Because, alongside this job, I was probably going out till 2 o'clock in the morning, three nights a week as well, which you wouldn't have the energy to do 10 years later.
Partying.
Yeah. So, and I had bought a house the year I qualified, even before I got my results. So I was also buying houses through those years. Whereas now, if I was advising someone, I'd be probably telling them, do one thing at one time. You're taking on too much. You have a new business and you're trying to learn how to buy houses. But it's, I suppose, I was never a nervous type. And I had quickly realized that accountancy isn't about numbers at all. You know, it's about the people around you getting the work done and wanting to do the work. So I really enjoyed it. And I suppose I realized about myself that once the job was really tidy and organized, it wasn't that challenging for me then. I was probably better then to replace myself and move on to someplace else that needed to be organized.
And bringing, so from chaos and order, I think that's the old terminology. So you obviously have moved along the employment stage and stages, and then you moved into your own self-employment. And maybe talk us through that. Suppose doing it for someone else, and obviously then going and to do it for yourself. Then, what was the main challenges there?
The challenge, really, I suppose, it's the first three clients, isn't it? And I suppose it's the same challenge for everybody. But a lot of people who, it's funny, sometimes when people describe themselves as entrepreneurs to me, and then I discover they're actually, and you have a single contract with one company. I said, well, that's not an entrepreneur. That's a lovely soft. That's, you know, your contract is secured. I knew I needed, say, probably three decent clients. Because my sort of sales line was, the company I set up was called FC On Call, for Financial Controller On Call. So you could book financial controller level services as you needed them. And I guesstimated that most places did only needed a day or two a week, even though they currently have full-time accountants. And I suppose my argument was, you'd be better paying having someone who's really commercially aware 2 days a week than having someone who's strictly a number cruncher 5 days a week.
Gap in the market, I suppose.
Yes.
Obviously, you've seen that. Tell us about that. How did you, what research did you do to see that gap?
When I look back, I had probably never heard the phrase test and measure, except I liked fathoming out. But I was most interested in how am I going to get these other three to do all of my work? How can I
listening to fathom it out? It's a technical term, an Irish technical term.
So I had realized quite quickly, because I was always working with the three or four staff I had to say, what could they learn next? I was running under the assumption that everyone wants to improve and everyone wants to learn more things, where looking back, maybe they didn't. But I, you know, the jobs traditionally done then by the accountant, I came to a stage where I had farmed out a lot of that work. So when I say when I arrived and there was an assistant accountant, an accountant, a financial controller and a company secretary, I replaced three of those people then just by getting organised. We never got another finance director and we never got another company secretary. So it forced me to look at everything I was doing and say, who else could do this? And you're saying, well, if we bought better scanners and we got this technology, that person would have an extra 8 hours a week. So that gave me the idea that loads of companies must be in this same boat. They must be actually have capacity, but they don't know the capacity. They think they're as efficient as they can be, but they're actually not. So when I initially went out on my own, no internet, remember, barely mobile phones. So you didn't stick up a Facebook ad and get clients. I used to reply to ads for accountants with a sort of a couple of testimonials. I had very few testimonials at that point. I'd done some odd jobs saying, Instead of replacing your a full time instead of getting a full time accountant, would you consider just a couple of days a week and getting really organised? And what I discovered then was most of the companies who I got in the beginning, they had trouble getting the right person or holding on to the right person. So sometimes they just expected too much of the person. And sometimes it, you know, it became obvious they just weren't getting great candidates because, say, they were maybe in a slightly out of the way location. And at the time, jobs were very plentiful, so accountants could pick and choose. The first 3 months probably was all messy, itty bitty little jobs. And I suppose it's the same for everyone. Just when you're nearly about to give up, I was offered 2 3-day weeks. And when I look back now, I mean, it was very well paid. I was €600 a day for 6 days a week. And I was 27, you know, I was 28 maybe by now. And I had friends still battling with the exams who were probably on, you know, I left industry on probably only less than £30,000 at the time. So I got really from once I got those 2 3 days, I was busy all the time. It's like everything. Once you get started and you prove you can do the job, I grew to having myself and 9 employees and I was never short of work. That was in a spell of probably only 3 years. And I was never short of work in once I got started at all.
And then suppose time, you were probably cash rich, but time poor. And
yes.
The light bulb moment of changing it up again came about, Catherine. And suppose everything just wasn't rosy for you either during that
yes.
time.
No, it was very busy because most of the clients you attract as a sort of a freelance financial controller, they're under pressure. Initially, they're under pressure for cash. I mean, that's why they're paying those kind of rates per day, because they want someone who can change, make a significant difference. But it takes a good while to make a significant difference. I mean, in lots of those places, we have to let half the staff go. You know, you can't do that overnight. So it was big reorganizations with the weight of responsibility and trying to pare back, getting them into profitability. But there's probably a year and a half, no matter how efficient you are, that they're still under severe pressure, plus you're invoicing them $7,000 a month maybe. So they're nervous. Is this going to work? Now, all of them, I think there was one organization we decided had to shut down. There just wasn't enough margin in what they were doing. They were selling a particular type of machine that you just would never sell enough of them in Ireland. You'd have to have been in Europe or exporting. But all of the others went from being barely turning a profit into being really profitable. But what I really learned, I suppose, with professional services is they want you, none of the 9 other people. When they're worried about money, when the staff are having problems, it's you that needs to come. It's no good saying, I'm going to send this other lady, she has the same amount of experience as me. I had some really, really strong accountants. I had the ex head of finance in Aircom. I had great people because I was giving them flexible working conditions when nobody seemed to even understand that mattered to people. You know, because these were now women in their early 30s, who some of them had small kids, and they would prefer to do, say, 3 10-hour days and have some days off during the week. But it was extremely busy. And alongside that, I probably now had 10 rental units. So this is between probably age 28, I can never remember the years, and age 33 or 34. So it was full on. It was accountancy by day, cash flow struggles for other people. I also was director of a building company building social houses. And then the night shift was the tenants with the broken washing machines, and I need a new microwave, and I had a row with my housemate. So it was extremely busy.
So it was from the accountancy right back to the property. And
yes.
A different dynamic, Catherine.
Yeah, it is, but again, it's all the same thing, really, I suppose. It's clear communication, not letting things go on week one because you're too tired that you're going to have to try and rectify in week 12, and systemize, and but a different dynamic in that property is the general public. If you're going the buy-to-let route, tenants are going to be a mixed bag. Where at least within a company structure, when you're supervising people, most of them know what's expected of them. You know, I always noticed we had to cut large amounts of staff places, and yet I only ever really had to actually sack someone. And people used to find this so interesting, oh, it's an awful job, sacking people. And so, well, you know what's really funny? I'd be completely honest with people and say, look, you know, half of your job is getting done, the other half is not. I'm just telling you this isn't sustainable. I'm not giving you a verbal warning. I'm just chatting to you as a person. And so many people would just leave willingly when you're really open and honest with them. And you say, you know, this isn't, you know yourself, this you mustn't be enjoying. And loads of them would say, oh, I don't like it at all. I'm actually glad we've had this conversation. I hate this work. And so therefore I'm not great at it. And I'm actually going to, sometimes you'd move people around within, but the people at least within a company, they have some idea of what's expected. Whereas of course, property, you know, you've a huge age range and everything. I'd have had students, families, all kind of different tenants. We didn't really profile tenants back then and say, I'll focus on students, or I'll focus on single lets, or I'll focus. You know, you took every applicant as they came. So yeah, different, but a lot of people demands, obviously, between the two things.
Yeah, and that aspect then, obviously, working with property and so it was like everybody else in the country back in the boom, you over-leveraged yourself as well. And suppose a question that probably nobody can answer, but obviously you working day by day with a financial head on you, you know, was it something that you didn't see coming, suppose, back when you had all those buy-to-lets and the issues that you would have? And look, then there was the deep recession that we had as well.
Yes, and I think in ways it was so easy you didn't even think about it. You know, you just bought, the first house I bought was 63,000 old money, and I sold it maybe 5 years later for 220,000 euro. So I wouldn't have had half. You know, now if I'm going buying a bloody pair of curtains, I'm doing due diligence and price comparisons. There was no history of prices, for starters. There was no property price register. You'd have to rely on an agent telling you what. But nobody knew what any street was worth because they were climbing at such a rate. You know, I remember people telling me 63,000 was too much for Cabra in Dublin because it used to be only 25,000 or 30,000 pounds. But I suppose, and the house equation is kind of like a business nearly when I look back now, that I would say to people now, when you've made a certain amount, you need to consider cashing out because it could be about to fall off a cliff. If you've experienced 300% growth, well, you're not going to have another 300 probably in the next. But I wouldn't have been thinking like that, no, at all, because that was only my sideline, remember. So I barely would have had time to think. I'd have had the revenue sheriff nearly every day for some client. But that stuff was more pressing. And my sideline was kind of nearly self-managing. It wasn't, you know. And I honestly think now, having dealt with hundreds of insolvency cases since, even if I thought, well, no, prices are going to go down, money was so available and everything, you would have felt, you would have really had to sit on your hands not to take the money and buy more.
So that time period, so just you came out of your own business, you came out of a full-time employment into your own business, went through the drama of setting it up and getting it going and making it profitable. And obviously then you looked at some extra cash flow that you had, you moved it into some property, and there was a continuation of a good business person here that was materialized. And suppose those years of that happening, and you know, you had such a high level of work and working in finance, and suppose, as I said in my last comment, it was a time where suppose the markets were rising, and money was cheap, and it was easy to get that. But did you ever think at one stage this could go pear shaped?
I did. I suppose it would cross your mind because it's such a thing of growth, and none of the companies in the non-property industries, you know, I was dealing with concrete companies, hire companies, all types of different, so service distribution, manufacturing, and none of them were experiencing the kind of growth property was experiencing. But still, there was kind of never a right time to stop. And I suppose I was lucky in some senses, even though it didn't feel like it initially. You know, I had no cross-secured. The worst things I come across now, and I literally had a statement of affairs in today now for a chap I have a review with next week, and I see all his assets are cross-secured. So he cannot get rid of some rubbish and keep the good stuff. So I had some, I suppose, redeeming things in that I had it spread. I had stuff abroad, in several places abroad. I had stuff in Ireland. And that's a plus and a minus. It's always portrayed as a minus, I suppose, when you go to property training. And I mean, I deliver property. We tell everyone you stick to one area, you really get to know. But if that area goes down, all your eggs are still in one basket. So some of the stuff I had abroad was actually doing quite well. Say, I had big rental returns. So I don't think, quite honestly, Warwick, even with older people were warning, this is going to stop, the prices are going to drop. What I would have to say too is that, remember, all the money I lost in property came from property initially. Not a huge amount of it came from accountancy. So I suppose in a way it's self-financed, but some of the great deals were lost then, having reinvested them.
So talk us through that time, Catherine. I'm just intrigued to figure out where your mindset was at that time. Suppose you did so well, as we said, you came out of a really good job, you set up your own business.
Yes, I got approached to buy my business, so I didn't even, it wasn't that I thought, how would you sell? So I had probably one of the first non-audit accountancy practices. So like I say, it was FC on call, and it was part-time financial controllers, and we were outsourced, and I could go in somewhere and say, you're paying two account staff there and you have an accountant coming in once a month and you still don't seem to know your figures and you're still not as profitable. So I will take the whole lot over for less than you're spending now, and then I would have to basically try and save 20% of the time, and that was my margin, I suppose. So got approached to sell the, first of all, I tried to replace myself in the business. I tried to hire a chief accountant. Didn't really work. People were too used of me, even though I got a great guy. And then it sort of made me smile when he said to me, I'm leaving Dublin, I'm going to the west of Ireland, he said, and I'm going to be surfing and out on the beach with the dog. And I was beginning to think, God, what am I doing? He's not even from the west of Ireland, and he can't. He said, this isn't really me. He said, this constant taking on other people's stresses So then I was approached to buy the business, which was probably perfect timing. And over a course of a couple of months, we worked that out. So I sold in 2007. So there was kind of a jubilant, well, the first 6 months I had to work and migrate the clients over. That was tedious. And that brought me into 2008, which anyone who has ever had a property knows was not a good year. There was probably a brief 6 months when I had lots of funds, all this freedom, which I hadn't had. I didn't really even allow myself time after college. I was just keen to get qualified, get the exams done. I set more exams faster than most people I know would sign up for. I used to study at 6 o'clock every, I'd study 6 to 9 in the morning, worked 9 to 5 and go to college in the evenings. So I'd never had the sort of freedom to just get up. So I spent a couple of months in Portugal and rested and what have you. And then, and all my property stuff was still going well. But then of course in 2008, it literally started falling through the sky. And really the biggest thing probably I regret now from then isn't actually the money or the houses at all. Is it was extremely stressful because I didn't know any other property people. So I felt like I was the only person in the world this was happening to. That one day I was a 35-year-old with a couple of million euro in equity, plus the money from my business. Now I had reinvested that into more property. But you went from that to being afraid to answer the phone, to being literally praying it would be Friday evening and Bank of Scotland would stop calling, you know? And I think that loads of people, I suppose, are familiar with that stress.
And is that something, suppose, it's an Irish thing, really, that talking about it at that stage, you know, it was difficult because obviously there was a lot of people losing the preferable shit at that stage. They were losing everything. It was a real tough time on families and tough times on individuals. And what was the one coping strategy that you would have used at that stage? Did you think that when you look back now, you thought that got me through it?
Probably switch off your mobile phone. It's not a very sophisticated coping mechanism. But nowadays, a bank cannot hound you the way they could do. You know, now it's all, you can only ring a person a certain amount of times a month. It was chronic in the beginning how much they rang. And I mean, you can't, my tenants had stopped paying. I'd actually rented my own house in Dublin because I knew that was the most way that I could still pay that mortgage was if I rented that for a while. But it was chronically stressful in the beginning. Then I was actually in a car accident and I'd ruptured discs. So that nearly overrode. The being actually in physical pain kind of overrides. You're not too bothered then about people chasing you because you're actually more distressed with that. But I would say the biggest coping once you find it is other people who are in the same boat. And to just even be able, even if someone had no idea what to do, if you could just tell somebody and unload to them, you don't want to tell your family, you don't want to stress them. You're trying still, maybe if you have other bank facilities, you know, some people have business banking, overdrafts and things then. They don't want the local bank manager to realise that the mortgages are in distress because they might cancel the overdraft facilities. So it has an awful knock-on effect for people. But I think the single biggest thing is if there's anybody that can tell, even if they're not an advisor, they're going to feel way, way better.
And from that, suppose you found another business out of it when the dust settled.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a lot of people going through the insolvency element, and unfortunately, there still are some people going through it as well.
Yes.
COVID-19 is going to really, you know, offer some situations for people, and let's put it that way, it is a situation and they can get out of it. And suppose you discovered that there was a market there for helping people as well. You went through it.
It's funny in a way how I came to be doing the insolvency cases is I was selling a house in negative equity and a solicitor was dealing with it for me. And I remember they had called me for the same information or emailed a couple of times. So I rang the principal of the firm and I said, you know, I'm not telling you your business, but you're all over the place in there. You have to have systems and procedures. And I sort of went back into my management consultant role. And he said, oh God, you're absolutely right. Would you come in and have a look at the place? So these guys had gone from probably nobody buying houses for a couple of years, 2008, 2009, 2010, to suddenly having hundreds and hundreds of house sales. But they all needed the bank's consent, because if you can't clear the mortgage, you need the bank's permission to sell. And really, we did a lot of work together and we eventually agreed. He said, this is more accountancy than legal. It's not a legal battle. It's about affordability and what's the most you'll get for it, what has to be paid out of it, what are the bank going to get, and how do we convince the bank that they should say, yes, thanks, please go ahead. So I went from only having experienced my own insolvency drama, I suppose, to suddenly taking over 200 cases one merry Monday morning. And that was very similar, really, to back in the day, going into situations where they couldn't pay their VAT that week. But I enjoyed knowing that once you organise this properly and you get a system in place to deal with them, I'm sure they're solvable. Maybe 80% of them can be solved. So I began to work through all of those. And then actually other solicitors started for work to me, and even accountants, who you'd just be chatting to them about something else or getting a copy of someone's tax return. And they'd say, oh, you seem to know a lot about the banks. And I begun to take on all these cases. Now, I had then also in the gap, I had completed the financial advisor exams and the personal insolvency practitioner exams, even though I never actually registered as an insolvency practitioner, because you don't have to register to do informal arrangements. So there was a kind of a combination of property and some legal. I've begun to learn a lot of the legal jargon from that and problem solving. So I've probably dealt with now 420 or 30 insolvency cases, different banks, different backgrounds and different levels of severity.
And so that's something you took a bit of solace out of it. You got yourself back up and running again, Catherine, by that business. And suppose then, tell us, you've moved on. You're still doing insolvency, but you've actually moved forward more aggressively into the property market and more into the property training as well. And the love of property hasn't left you. You seem to be very passionate about.
I still like it. I still love it. I suppose back in the day when I started buying property first, I never bought anything that needed work done with, even though I was always interested in interiors and I liked that type of stuff. I was so busy, I had to buy things that were ready made and that you could get tenants in pretty much straight away. So then I suppose through doing all the insolvency cases, by the time I was 3 years into doing those, the first ones were starting to come back to ask me, we're thinking of buying again. What would you warn us to do or not to do? And I got to thinking then, gosh, I know so much now. Apart from my own journey, I have now 430 cases in front of me of the what went wrong here. So there's almost nothing that I cannot foresee that can go wrong. And also around the same time, I suppose, I became aware of property training companies in the UK and Irish people going there. But then I realised, no, their advice is quite specific to the UK. And the law is similar. The law moves a lot faster in the UK. So these guys are buying up this distressed property. Once they miss 2 months' payments, they'll be going to repossession courts. Whereas we don't have that situation here because you could miss 3 years' payments and still not be repossessed. So I began to see there was a gap for somebody to do training specific to the Irish market. And meanwhile, I had moved fully, really, to flipping property myself. I had sort of had a belly full of tenants, really, I suppose, because I, at the time when I had the tenants and I had a very busy business, it always seemed like an extra pressure, an extra. So I began to really enjoy the transformation. I suppose the properties that were for sale in 5-6 years ago, and they're still there. There's an awful lot of ex-rentals that are run down because nobody can afford to bring them up to. They're barely able to cover the mortgages, the income tax, the management fees. And so there's lots of distressed stuff around. And I began to realize I love doing these up and selling them on as often first-time buyer starter homes. So that's now my end of the market. And I do training. Some of the people I train want to do that. They're at a similar kind of stage to myself. And then some people still want to own 50 buy-to-lets. And they're generally younger people who want to have a huge portfolio. And they don't mind the responsibility, the hassle. Where I'm always weighing up the amount of, the amount of effort and annoyance versus the returns, I suppose.
And what's the biggest piece of advice you give anyone, suppose, look, from an entrepreneur's journey there, Catherine, it's just been a roller coaster for you, from the highs to the lows to having loads of income to losing the whole thing. What advice would you give someone now, suppose, either A, looking at investment, or B, starting a business? I know they're parallel, really. What would you indicate would be the best bit of advice?
I suppose number one, before you start at all, and maybe you'd need to ask family or friends this, is have you the temperament for it? Because nothing is worth a nervous breakdown. I'd have insolvency clients that should never ever have bought a buy-to-let. They just were not mentally resilient enough for the downside. It absolutely destroyed them and kept them awake at night. And I had people, awful stuff. Like I had a lovely client who died stress-related while we were dealing with her case. There are people who shouldn't. Their appetite for risk is low, and that's absolutely fine, each to their own. But don't just jump on the bandwagon because you see other people doing it. We're all different. And then I think if you establish that, yes, I want to do this. I want to build a portfolio. There obviously property is kind of, your lowest risk, lowest aggro is probably doing, investing money hands off with somebody or going with council, long-term lets and not dealing with tenants yourself. So in property, you can choose something that's lower stress and lower risk nowadays. Business is sort of full throttle. And I suppose with business, I would say, get yourself a mentor, with similar outlook to yourself and experience of your industry, but also just do one little piece at a time. And when you have that piece right, want the next piece. I think most people start trying to run before they can walk. And, they've nothing systemized. They don't know their targets. They don't know their numbers. They don't know their margin. And then it all gets too much and they're barely able to keep juggling all the things.
And yeah, it is the boring parts that you have to really, suppose you get these great ideas and you get,
yes.
I fell into that trap as well in my journey, and just, you can have all these great ideas, but when it comes to really, really filtering it down on the spreadsheet, it might not just look as good, and enthusiasm yes. could run out very quickly. But do you see that quite a lot in the summary and a property decision? Some people go on and you buy it, and you go, "What did you do that for?" And you know, it's
yes. It's, and some people are so cautious that they'll never get around to buying. They're over analytical. And I suppose that's where you should balance yourself up, isn't it, with a mentor. So say for someone setting up an accountancy firm or a traditional, they are probably cautious. I would have been an unusual. There was probably 80 accountants in my class when we used to go to evenings and weekends. And there was only about four of us who were friends, because most accountants are cautious by nature. So an accountant should really hire a mentor who's a more social animal and who understands business, networking, sales, marketing. Whereas someone who's a really good salesperson for driving, they should hire maybe a cautious person. So that the seesaw, you know, when the seesaw goes out of balance, somebody will fly off it and injure themselves.
Now, obviously, that's something you're passionate about, something you've looked at over the years, and you know, giving back that little bit of mentorship and as well, and to give some guidance to really enthusiastic people. Sometimes is that something you really enjoy, Catherine?
It is, and something I wouldn't have been aware of at all, I suppose, when I started out, is how to. What you want will change as you get older. Even it's not just there's entrepreneurs and there's people who would never want to be an entrepreneur. But also there's entrepreneurs in their teens, their 20s, their 30s. So I love the kind of real gung-ho 20-something. And then I do sort of completely different work with the people who are around 50-ish. Who are often trying to shed some of their business, hold on to the little bit they love, and work less or retain their earnings. So I do find it very interesting. It's not just personality, I think, it's age. The people who were gung-ho, will slow down as well. I mean, an odd person dies at their desk. But it's an awful shame when they do. Most people regret that they didn't wind it down a bit while they could have.
So what you're telling me is that you were all gung-ho from an early age, got the business, got it sold, got the property, went bust and came back. And
yeah.
it's kind of looking back and, obviously those things happening to you have shaped your opinion now and how you think and process things.
They do, and sometimes other people know that without having to go through the whole roller coaster. You know, it's I absolutely love that story, the parable, the Mexican fisherman, about, you know, and the Mexican fisherman lives a nice, relaxed life, and he just earns, he fishes what he has to keep going. And about chatting to an American who keeps telling him you could scale up and you could do this and you could buy trawlers and all of this. And of course, the story goes full circle that the Mexican says, "Oh, what would I do then when I retired and I sold my businesses for billions?" And he said, "You'd move to a beach in Mexico and you'd relax and you'd only work." And the but I'm here already. So I find it interesting that some people sort of seem to understand balance from the get-go, whereas I would have a tendency to overwork and then say, "No, that's too much." And I find it very interesting dealing with people, I suppose, at the beginning and at the turning point now.
Well, Catherine, it's been a great hour's chat on the Breadwinners podcast. Thanks for joining us and taking us time out of your weekend. And before we let you go, we ask all our interviewees just, you know, three top things you would give entrepreneurs now who are starting out on their journey. What would they be? Just three
tips, I suppose. One, know your own personality. Even if you have to go and do a personality test. There's a book I enjoyed called The Four Tendencies from Gretchen Rubin, and it explains why some of us are work differently to others. And it's to do with expectations, what others expect of us and what we expect of ourselves. So know yourself, or you'll never know what you'll be good and bad at. Number two, focus on a tiny bit first and get that right and add another little bit. And number three, I think it's fine to give up the rest of your life for a few years. It's actually more efficient to just go all in for a couple of years. Now, if you already have small kids, that's not practical and you don't want to miss them being small. But if you're single and you can, but with bearing in mind that it defeats the purpose of having your own business if 25 years down the line you're still having to do all the jobs yourself. You know, but I feel like, and I don't really believe in that nonsense about it's only year one, you're not going to make a profit. You know, your overhead should be left. There's no reason most businesses can't be profitable from the get-go, except that they overspend for what they're bringing in. So I'd say number three, yeah, go all in by all means for 3 years. But if you still have to work 70 hours a week after 3 years, there's something wrong. Go and talk to somebody about it and, you know, track it out, write down your hours. You probably haven't systemized yourself enough.
Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you by Gap Property Investments, helping you get a better return on your money through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com. And also, it's brought to you by CityStays, offering bespoke accommodation for large teams of employees or subcontractors that requires accommodation quickly. Check out CityStays.ie.
Definitely three big ones: the personality test, to focus on the tiny bits first, and you know, we emphasized on the tiny parts because we can try and do a little bit of everything. Give up the rest of your life if you've, you know, for a couple of years, that the sacrifice that it's going to take. And what's in the horizon for you, Catherine, suppose, before we let you go?
I suppose I'm at the sort of cutting down to 3.5 days a week pace. And what's actually interesting when you have workaholic tendencies is you kind of don't know what to do the other 2 days. Everyone is telling you, you're so lucky you're able to do. Would you actually, what did I do this morning? I went and bought paint and curtain poles and did a load of work. And it's actually harder, I think, in ways to build a life than a business. I sometimes think people say they're a workaholic. And I say, you know, it's a nice safe place to hide because nobody queries you when you say you're at work. It actually can be harder to build a balance and to kind of pick back up a hobby when you're not 15. You know, but it's great to see people going back to golf, to football. I started horse riding again about 3 years ago after 25 years. And sure enough, I had a serious tumble within the first few weeks. I hit a tree full pelt and flew off the horse into a tree. And of course, everyone said, oh, sure, at your age, it's insane, you know. There's people in their 80s skydiving. You can't. I think in a lot of ways, when you've worked a lot, it's actually harder to pick back up life. It's just easier to stay at the desk. But you wouldn't, I don't have any doubt that you'll regret it later. So for me, it's finding balance is hard enough.
Getting that 3.5 days working as well. So, but look, Catherine, it's been a great hour chatting to you. We've covered so much, the highs of business, the lows of business, and keeping it all together, which is very important as well.
Yes.
And as obviously some of our listeners might be looking for those property tips as well, they can check you out. You've got, you're all across the socials. Maybe you'll give them a plug for us.
Yeah, perfect. I'm Catherine Brennan, obviously, on LinkedIn. And on Facebook, it's Catherine Brennan Property, or and on Instagram, it's Intelligent Property. So anywhere you find us, we can link you into the private Facebook group and anything. And it's happy to hear from anyone. I think the collective is brilliant, just for ideas and for, you have an idea sometimes, and then when you're in a group, it's great because other people can see the weakness in the idea and help you out straight away.
And for Pacific Property Training, you also do that as well. And I know that you had a week, a couple of days coming up there, but unfortunately, due to the COVID restrictions now,
yes, it's postponed. So we've a full website with all the training offerings at intelligentpropertytraining.ie, and we're also on YouTube, actually, at Intelligent Property, and there's a good bit of video content which can be easier to listen to than reading written posts.
Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you by Gap Property Investments, helping you get a better return on your money through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com. And also, it's brought to you by CityStays, offering bespoke accommodation for large teams of employees or subcontractors that requires accommodation quickly. Check out CityStays.ie.